You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up, Circle A Radio, starting now. It is
6:03. You know, a person's first reaction to finding out that they're in an organization which is being watched is, well, why are they watching us? I mean, we're not doing anything illegal, which is true. We weren't, and we're not. And of course, they have to understand why, and people have to explain it to them. You know, why is the state, you know, paying so much attention to an organization whose work is, you know, is public work? And when you get into that, you get into the whole area of what is a state that looks like it's free, unquote, but in fact is extremely repressive.
Welcome to Circle A Radio. Tonight we'll be looking at the history of U.S. government's domestic surveillance programs. The recent cases of the National Security Agency spying on American citizens have now gained widespread media coverage. We're not hearing a lot about other types of intimidation. We'll be speaking with Lauren Regan from the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, Oregon, about how grand juries work and their role in repression. We'll also be speaking with Professor Brian Glick, author of The War at Home, Covert Action Against U.S. Activists and What We Can Do About It. First, we bring some voices, past and present, of people who are intimately familiar with these tactics. This is former Black Panther Party member and Portland resident Kent Ford.
And I got a call from a friend, and I hadn't heard from this friend for 25 years. But he says, Kent, this is the worst I've ever seen it. He said, even during our day, back in the SNCC days and the Black Panther days, he said it wasn't this bad. And I said, you're certainly right.
If the political repression activists face is worse now than it's ever been, we need to look at the past for lessons learned and for parallels to our current struggles. We put together the following history lesson in an effort to connect the past to the present. Some of the historical material came from a documentary called Me and My Shadow, a history of the FBI's covert operations and COINTELPRO. It was narrated by Don Sorda and produced by Addie Gevins for Pacifica Radio in 1976.
Do you ever get the feeling you are being watched? If you are active in any organization on the left, you probably are.
In 1791, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, or the Bill of Rights, provided legal protection of basic civil rights. Civil liberties guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution included freedom of speech, of the press, and of assembly. The Constitution provided citizens protection from unreasonable search and seizure. In 1798 marked the passing of the Alien and Sedition Acts. These acts were created in part to silence government critics. They granted the president the power to imprison or deport any alien suspected of sedition, and its wide-ranging restrictions of spoken criticism against the government or the president. The Sedition Act significantly reduced First Amendment protections of speech and of the press. During the period between 1860 and 1865, the first violations of First Amendment protections were documented during the Civil War. During wartime paranoia, the U.S. government censored telegraph communications and punished journalists for publishing opinion editorial pieces. Newspapers critical of the Lincoln administration were banned from the mail. In 1962, Lincoln established military tribunals. Any U.S. citizen accused of resisting military drafts or guilty of giving aid and comfort to the rebels would be tried under military law. Hundreds of civilians were arrested and tried in military tribunals. Thus, they were denied the constitutional protection of trial by jury in a civilian court. With the entry of the United States into World War I, the government became increasingly concerned about rising anti-war sentiment by the labor and radical movements. Organized labor was lobbying for their right to collective bargaining, as well as reduced working hours and better working conditions. By order of the War Department, police were authorized to repress any activities committed under the term seditious intent. The government stepped up its campaign of repression against activists and foreign immigrants. In 1917, Congress passed the Espionage Act. It prescribed a $10,000 fine and 20 years imprisonment for interfering with recruitment of troops or the disclosure of information dealing with national defense. Criticized as unconstitutional, the act resulted in the imprisonment of many in the anti-war movement, including Eugene V. Debs, Max Eastman, and Emma Goldman. In 1918, the Sedition Act was further refined to make it illegal to criticize the war effort in almost any manner.
This is David Cole, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and legal affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine.
In 1919, there were a series of terrorist bombings in the United States, including mail bombs that were delivered to one of the chief justices of the Supreme Court, to several senators, including a person who blew off the front of the home of Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. And the government responded at that time not by going out and capturing the bombers. They never found the bombers. Instead, they went out and picked up somewhere between 4,000 and 10,000 foreign nationals using immigration authority, locked them up, interrogated them incommunicado, and ultimately deported hundreds of them, not based on involvement in terrorism, not based on involvement in the bombing, but based on either pretextual immigration charges, overstaying visas, or political association with the Communist Party or some communist organization.
These raids took place in several American cities and became known as the Palmer Raids.
And they used immigration law at the time because they could. Not because they thought the bombers were immigrants, but because the laws permitted them to do to foreign nationals what they couldn't do to citizens, to employ guilt by association, to hold people without showing them the evidence against them. And the architect of that was not Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, but a young man just out of George Washington Law School, whose first job in the Justice Department had been regulating enemy aliens during World War I, and whose second job was heading up the Radical Alien Division of the Justice Department. And that man was J. Edgar Hoover.
The scope of FBI operations has been increasing since its formation in 1924. Political surveillance is handled by the Bureau's Domestic Intelligence Division, which dates its authority from 1939, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt ordered the FBI to investigate matters relating to espionage and sabotage. So long as J. Edgar Hoover and his successors to the directorship could convince the legislature that the government is in imminent danger of communist subversion, funds could be obtained for extensive programs of domestic surveillance. Programs which are subject to only the most minimal review by elected representatives of the people.
After the December 7, 1941 Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Roosevelt delegated military authority to sign Executive Order 9066, which culminated in the internment of ethnic Japanese from West Coast communities. After the Second World War ended, the Cold War began. Between 1947 and 1954, the House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC, had been officially established. Its purpose was threefold. First, it intended to prove that the Hollywood Screenwriters Guild had communist members. Second, it hoped to show that these writers were able to insert subversive propaganda into Hollywood films. Third, J. Parnell Thomas, head of the committee, argued that President Roosevelt had encouraged pro-Soviet films during the war. Although none of these claims were ever substantiated, the committee's tactics forced many talented and creative people to leave Hollywood. Between 1947 and 1954, more than 50 explicitly propagandistic anti-communist films were made in Hollywood. During this time, U.S. Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy led intense anti-communist inquiries, later known as witch hunts.
This is Bill Mandel, who was a KPFA radio programmer for 37 years. He's testifying in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1960.
My name is William Mandel. I live at 233 Lake Drive, Berkeley.
You're appearing today in response to a subpoena which is heard upon you by this committee?
I do.
And you're represented by counsel?
I am.
Counsel.
To the degree that a counsel not able to speak for me can represent me.
Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Communist Party?
Sir, I am 42 years of age and have never had to face a jury as defendant or grand jury as witness in my life. I have committed no crime under any of the laws of this country and am not engaged in subversion. Consequently, I refuse to testify on the grounds that as a radio and TV public affairs broadcaster active in those capacities today, the subpoena issued to me interferes with the rights of my stations to schedule informational programs on their merits, and is thus a direct violation of the First Amendment guarantee of freedom of speech and of the people's right to hear. I certainly shall not answer questions representing allegations against me made by persons not present and not identified, whom I cannot confront, and whom my lawyer cannot cross-examine as to their truthfulness.
Do you honestly apprehend, sir, that if you told this committee truthfully while you're under oath whether or not you are now this instant or ever have been a member of the Communist Party, you would be supplying information which might be used against you in a criminal proceeding?
Honorable beaters of children and sadists uniformed and in plain clothes, distinguished Dixiecrat wearing the clothing of a gentleman, eminent Republican who opposes an accommodation with a one country with which we must live at peace in order for us all and our children to survive. My boy of 15 left this room a few minutes ago in sound health and not jailed solely because I asked him to be in here to learn something about the procedures of the United States government and one of its committees. Had he been outside where the son of a friend of mine had his head split by these goons operating under your orders, my boy today might have paid the penalty of permanent injury or a police record for desiring to come here and hear how this committee operates. If you think that I am going to cooperate with this collection of Judases, of men who sit there in violation of the United States Constitution, if you think I will cooperate with you in any way, you are insane.
Now, sir, were you a lecturer?
In 1956, the Federal Bureau of Investigation launches its counterintelligence program, or COINTELPRO.
Earth First organizer Judy Berry.
What they did to us was, the term for this in the FBI is COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program. And what that means, this is a program that was started by J. Edgar Hoover back in the bad old days, and now in the bad new days, they still do it. And COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO, that J. Edgar Hoover described it as a way of targeting domestic radical groups that they think are a threat to the U.S. government. So I guess that's quite a compliment to us, and I guess we're a threat to Charles Hurwitz, and he's more powerful than the government, so maybe it all adds up. But anyway, what J. Edgar Hoover described COINTELPRO as a program, these are his words, to expose, misdirect, isolate, and neutralize political groups that he didn't like. And that's really what's been done to Earth First. And the methods that they used in COINTELPRO include disinformation, fake documents, infiltration, agent provocateurs, fomenting infighting within a group, getting the group to do things so that they will be discredited, and also framing and assassinating leaders. And the most famous victims of COINTELPRO, you probably all know that Martin Luther King was spied on in his motel room. And that, you know, of course, in the Black Panthers, there were many Panthers killed, 32 in all. Fred Hampton was a famous victim of COINTELPRO. He was murdered in his bed. Geronimo Pratt, and he, in fact, was framed by the very same guy, Richard Held, the same guy that was in charge of our case at the FBI, was in charge of Geronimo's case down in Los Angeles. Leonard Peltier is another very well-known victim of COINTELPRO. And what they did in these cases, in the Black Panthers, they didn't just frame Geronimo. Before they framed him and put him in jail, they fomented infighting within the leadership so that people in the Black Panthers thought that Geronimo was an FBI agent, so that when he was then framed, the other Panthers wouldn't testify in his behalf. And one of the ways that they fomented this infighting is that they had these, like, nasty cartoons. Now, the FBI doesn't make up the divisions in your group. They take real divisions, and they kind of fan the flames of them. So there was another group, a Black nationalist group, as opposed to a Black revolutionary group, which was the Panthers was, and the other group was called United Slaves, or US, U.S. And the leader of the United Slaves was named Karenga. So what they did is they had these cartoons, and these cartoons were sent from one faction to the other and back and forth, cartoons, death threats, and insulting letters. And each faction, thinking that the cartoons and letters were from the other faction, and they were all from the FBI, until everybody, there were actually two Panthers killed in the fighting that resulted from this, which they considered a great success.
Editor-in-Chief of the Intercommunal News Service of the Black Panther Party discusses the relationship of the FBI to that organization.
There is a host of evidence suggesting the active participation and involvement of paid agents, informers, and contract agents of the various intelligence services of this country, alleged intelligence services of this country, their participation in the activities of the party as members and as leaders.
This is Bobby Seale, founder, chairman, and national organizer of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense.
I mean, by the end of 1969, I had 29 Black Panther Party members dead. 14 policemen were dead. And all those shootouts and attacks on our offices, because the particular year of 1969, they attacked every Black Panther Party office in this country at least once. Black Panther Party was one of the most profound, take no crap from the racist pig power structure, grassroots, progressive, class analysis style organization, which evolved out of the grassroots of the African American community in this country. Black Panther Party was not separate from the civil rights movement, it was part of it. In fact, the Black Panther Party, because they murdered Martin Luther King, was catapulted into a broad spokesman, but program organizing kind of leadership angle in opposition to what we call the racist pig power structure. I mean, the FBI counterintelligence program, that program, because they call the COINTELPRO, you can go to the Library of Congress right now and read, really, all the dirty tricks and the violation of constitutional rights of the Freedom of Information Act documents. You can read this stuff. We got still people laboring around here that the Black Panther Party was a black militant hate group. Oh, please, give me a break. You didn't have time for it. You get shot at going to jail, you want all the friends you could get. And anyway, we picked up from Mao Zedong in the Little Red Book, know the difference between your friends and your enemies. Another thing we picked up, we began to find out that some of these fools coming in our organization were nothing but black provocative agents sent in by the FBI. So they ain't got nothing to do with no cops. It has to do, I guess, with Martin Luther King said, the content of your character. That's what it has to do with.
Louis Tackwood worked as an undercover informer for the criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department. He claims that he also worked for the FBI. In November 1971, Tackwood testified at the trial of 13 Panther Party members in Los Angeles. That trial stemmed from a 1969 attack on Black Panther headquarters by an FBI-trained SWAT team of the Los Angeles Police Department.
The chief prosecution witness in that trial was Melvin Cotton Smith, a leading member of the L.A. Panthers at the time of the alleged shootout.
U.S. Deputy District Attorney Ronald H. Carroll maintained that Smith had turned state's evidence to avoid prosecution. Tackwood testified that Smith had been an informer since 1969.
Louis Tackwood's testimony revealed an insider's view of the extent of FBI infiltration.
District Attorney Carroll asked me, I think, one question. What did I know about the Panther Party at the present time? And I think I asked him which one, the police department's Panther Party or the Panther Party, you know.
There are mountains of evidence that those individuals, some of whom have been revealed, others of whom have not, acted in ways to provoke confrontations between the party and the police and other armed elements of the power structure. The Black Panther Party considers 26 members, former members, as martyrs, having fallen in the course of the struggle, the history of this organization.
In 1971, files were stolen from the Bureau's office in Media, Pennsylvania, by a group calling itself the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI. Information contained in those files has enabled other investigators to obtain more documents by suing the Bureau under the Freedom of Information Act. The heavily censored documents turned over by the FBI as a result of those suits revealed the existence of extensive domestic counterintelligence programs called COINTELPROs. They used legal and illegal methods to infiltrate, disrupt, and harass politically active citizens.
Congressman Ron Dellums reads from one of these documents.
Counterintelligence program, internal security, disruption of the new left. Our nation is undergoing an era of disruption and violence caused to a large extent by various individuals generally connected with the new left. Some of these activities urge revolution in America and call for the defeat of the United States in Vietnam. They continually and falsely allege police brutality and do not hesitate to utilize unlawful acts to further their so-called causes. The new left has on many occasions viciously and scurrilously attacked the director of the FBI in an attempt to hamper our investigation of it and to drive us off the college campuses. With this in mind, it is our recommendation that a new counterintelligence program be designed to neutralize the new left and the key activists. The key activists are those individuals who are the moving forces behind the new left and on whom we have intensified our investigation, the new left. I think when you get into those kind of labels, there's awesome potential to abuse people. And so you take this kind of statement and you move against any organization that any informant or any agent or any person out there says is a new left group. You automatically says that equals danger, that equals violence. And then you justify a massive program to infiltrate these organizations. Now, what is the role of the government to do this?
Again, Judy Berry.
So eventually COINTELPRO was exposed, and it was exposed not because of anything the U.S. government did, but because in 1971, some people, we know not who, broke into the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, and liberated the files. And back then, they used to be very open. They called it COINTELPRO. They said, we have an order to neutralize Huey Newton. They even had an order to neutralize Tom Hayden. And, hey, didn't they do it? So they got these files, about 10,000 pages of them, and they went through them, and they exposed this just really horrible program. program. And it took them 4 years to get a congressional hearing. But they eventually got a congressional hearing in the Senate before Senator Church. It was called the Church Committee, and this was in 1975.
In September 1975, Senator Frank Church questioned the former chief of the FBI's Domestic Intelligence Division about former FBI Director Hoover's approval of the large-scale investigation of American college students.
Can you clarify for me which techniques that you're stating the director approved, which would have been illegal?
Well, there were a number of activities included. B of these activities was opening cases on approximately 4,000 black student activists, all members of the black student unions and similar groups, regardless of their past or present involvement in disorders. And it involved the opening cases on approximately 6,500 new left student activists, black and white, to determine whether they have a propensity for violence. Now, how do you investigate a person to find out whether he has a propensity for violence?
How do you investigate a propensity for violence? The FBI's answer is to flood targeted groups with informers who often act as provocateurs.
First agent I ever knew was in SDS, and he was a provocateur. So I didn't trust him, work with him. I thought he was crazy. And so did almost everybody else in the SDS chapter. He was just someone who was just always running his mouth off about, you know, we would want to demonstrate someplace and he'd want to blow it up, only he wanted to blow up a dorm.
One thing we know that NSA was basically not regulated, and we know that from the Vietnam War days and the Watergate era that NSA was doing a lot of this political spying internally. And then, of course, we had hearings. We had Frank Church in the Senate. We had Otis Pike and Bella Abzug over on the House hold hearings. And what we got out of this was the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which limited what NSA could do and set up this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that said that NSA could only eavesdrop on U.S. persons. And that's the U.S. companies, individuals, green card holders living in the United States. They could only do that if there was a court order from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court.
And at that time, they ruled, the U.S. Senate committee ruled that COINTELPRO was illegal, that it violated basic constitutional rights of U.S. citizens. And as a result of this, you may have heard of the Attorney General guidelines. This is what's kind of being undermined by the counterterrorism bill. So they passed these things called the Attorney General guidelines, and they set rules for the FBI and what they could and couldn't do. And what they said they couldn't do is they cannot spy on people, they cannot harass people, they can't engage with people because of political activities. That's what they're banned from doing. They're only allowed to investigate crime. They're not allowed to investigate radical political groups or any political groups. They are allowed to investigate a group if the group is a terrorist group. And yet what we've found in our case is that, you know how with the forestry rules, they have all these forestry rules, you know, so that we have the strongest rules in the United States and all that stuff, but they do this little dance around the rules and they still cut down every tree in the forest. Well, the FBI does the exact same thing with the Attorney General guidelines, okay? They do this little dance around them, but they still manage to do whatever they feel like. And what we found out in the bombing case and in 1990, what we've been learning ever since, is that really what they've been doing to Earth First is exactly the kind of COINTELPRO that they did to the Panthers, that they did to AIM, not quite on the same scale. They haven't killed 32 of us. But nonetheless, the same methodologies that they used against the Panthers and AIM and all of those other groups are the same methodologies that they've used to try to isolate and neutralize and misdirect Earth First.
You're listening to Circle A Radio. This is KPU 90.7 FM, Portland.
This is the voice of Brian Glick, Fordham University law professor and author of War at Home.
Anti-terrorism is the new anti-communism. In the 30s and the 40s and 50s and even into the early part of the 60s, it was all about mostly in the 60s, was about communism. And then as that became less and less credible as a pretext, they began to shift to terrorism, which is even funnier given the extent to which they practice terrorism around the world.
Journalist and author Christian Parenti.
The standard way in which federal investigators are supposed to achieve permission to search your home or tap your telephone is through what's called a Title III warrant. It's part of Title III of the U.S. Criminal Code. To receive a Title III warrant, federal investigators must meet three criteria that has to be reached. First and foremost, the investigators have to show probable cause to a judge that there has been a crime committed or that there are objects or documents that are legally subject to seizure in a certain premise. Then they have to show that all other means of obtaining this material have been exhausted. The third thing is they have to show that their search has a material bearing on an ongoing investigation. So if you have a fair judge, it can be a difficult set of criteria to meet. Therefore, investigators have, since 1978, tended to use instead the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, otherwise known as FISA. A FISA warrant is permitted on much lower evidence approved. In fact, what federal investigators have to do is certify that they need this warrant, and they have to certify that there is a intelligence and national security element to their search. Actually, they have to certify that they used to have to certify that that was the primary reason for their search, something to do with intelligence, and they just certify that. In other words, they don't have to show material fact. They just essentially assert to a judge, and then the judge literally automatically has to give them a FISA warrant. And basically, every single FISA warrant ever requested except for one has been granted. Under a FISA warrant, there is no notice to the subject of the search that they're being searched or that their phone is being tapped. So anyway, now there are more FISA warrants before 9/11. There were more FISA warrants granted than there were Title III warrants. And the standard practice developed was that federal investigators would claim that there was a foreign intelligence element to their investigation or that it was the key element to their investigation. They would collect as much evidence as they could. They weren't allowed to use this evidence in criminal court because there's a lower standard of proof. And the lower standard of proof is allowed because the idea is you're not going to throw someone in jail. You're just finding out about the world and about threats that America faces, whatever. So once they gather enough information, they can then just switch tracks to a Title III. And if they really want to search your house and get documents or whatever, then they use the evidence they've gained from the FISA warrant, get a Title III warrant, and collect the evidence that way. They also had the material witness law at their disposal. Now, a material witness is not a suspect. A material witness is someone who may have useful information about a case and may be a flight risk. And that person can be essentially jailed indefinitely. So the USA Patriot Act, what does it do? Well, it merges more formally FISA and Title III. So now federal investigators can obtain FISA warrants even when intelligence isn't the primary reason. So now it just has to be a reason. In other words, they get carte blanche with FISA. The Patriot Act also allows for judge shopping in that federal investigators can get a warrant in one jurisdiction to use in any other jurisdiction. Patriot Act also allows for interagency cooperation. The FBI, the CIA, the NSA, Defense Intelligence Agency can all share files on American citizens and immigrants who have not committed crimes, who have not been charged of crimes, who are not even suspect of crimes. So they also, in 1996, they created special alien terrorist courts. As for immigrants, the rules were always very, very lax. Any immigrant deemed out of status, that is, if you're a student and you're on a student visa and you're not in school, you can be arrested and deported for that. If you overstay your visa by a day, you can be arrested and deported for that. So immigrants have had a wafer-thin margin of error even before 9/11. And since 1996, there's been a law which allows federal prosecutors to arrest and deport any immigrant on secret evidence. that the immigrant and their defense cannot see. They also had grand juries at their disposal. Grand juries can be impaneled for up to 18 months. They were created in the early 70s. Again, this is an investigation tool. This is not being tried or charged with anything. If you're called before a grand jury, you have to answer their questions. If you don't, they will threaten you with immunity, which sounds nice, right? Whatever, you get immunity. Actually, being threatened with immunity is very, very serious. They say, oh, well, we're going to grant you immunity, and you, as a result, you have to snitch out the people you're associated with. And if you don't, you get perjury, and that's 5 years in prison.
Again, Brian Glick.
The grand juries are for real investigations, but also just to scare people, or to intimidate them out of continuing their activity, or to punish them and jail people who won't give testimony that they want. As far as I know, there's still not a legal obligation to talk with the FBI or the police or other investigators without a court order or a subpoena. And that's crucial because it's the main way they go around both gathering information and intimidating people through these kinds of supposed interviews. But that's one dimension of the way that they function. And we need to prepare for that dimension. People need to know their rights. People need to have proactive, pre-established relations with lawyers. One way you can deal with an FBI request for an interview is simply, you can say no. Or you can say, you know, call my lawyer so-and-so and we'll arrange a meeting where the lawyer is present. So what the FBI wants is to get you alone and intimidated. The documents show the FBI also operating more covertly, placing false stories in the media, forging documents that are leaflets and pamphlets and putting them out in the name of organizations to make the organizations appear violent, appear to be racist, appear to be anti-Semitic, whatever it is that's useful to the FBI, or forging correspondence between activists in order to, you know, driving people apart. They would infiltrate, and the infiltrators would spread false stories and make false charges, or they would use forged correspondence or anonymous phone calls or anonymous letters. And one of the things they love to do is use forgeries or infiltrators to make a genuine activist appear to be the agent. Some people will defend the agent, others people the target of the what's called a snitch jacket. And other people will attack them, and the group gets all focused on that, maybe splits or drives people out. These have been very effective. So there's all of this covert stuff going on in the 60s and then continuing. I think that more than anything else, all of these activities are designed to scare people and to distract us, to divert our attention. And while it's important to be aware of what the FBI and the police and other agencies do and do our best to cope with it, it's most important to not lose track of what brought us together in the first place and the changes that we need to make. Because if they turn us into organizations that are only fighting repression, they will have succeeded even if we push back the repression, because we won't be building a movement for real change in the country.
Civil Liberties Defense Center was founded in June 2003 in Eugene, Oregon. They are a nonprofit organization of practicing public interest attorneys and organizers focused on defending the civil rights of all citizens, particularly activists exercising their constitutional rights, and confronting recent political and legislative attacks on basic liberties.
This is Lauren Regan of the Civil Liberties Defense Center.
We're basically trying to fill a hole that we saw in the progressive activist world for legal knowledge and legal skills, and we try to work with existing communities to fill that void.
We started by asking Lauren Regan of the Civil Liberties Defense Center to explain the grand jury process.
There are grand juries that take place in both the state court system and the federal court system. I will primarily focus on the federal system because that's what most folks are probably focused on at this point. A grand jury is made up of about 23 citizens from around the state. Their names are pulled from voter registration or property records or other known name databases. A grand jury can basically sit for 18 months at a time unless they get an extension, which they definitely can request and get extensions in six-month increments. Grand juries meet in secret. Historically, that has been to protect the privacy and the reputation of the witness that was appearing before the grand jury. But in modern times, we're finding that this secrecy often serves to protect the government's private agenda rather than protecting the privacy of the witnesses. The only people allowed in a grand jury are the subpoenaed witness, the prosecutor, and the court stenographer, in addition to the jurors themselves. The attorneys for the people who have been subpoenaed to a grand jury actually have to basically sit out in the hallway, and the witness is allowed to leave the witness stand to go out and confer with their attorney, you know, after every question or after every couple of questions. Grand juries are actually, you know, a tool of criminal investigation. The prosecutor entirely controls the information that is provided to a juror because the prosecutor gets to put on whoever he or she wants to testify. The defendant has no right to present any evidence at all at a grand jury. And so obviously the information that's being provided is very, very skewed to one side. Any felony in Oregon, especially state or federal, any felony crime, whether it's a drug crime, whether it is arson, whether it's murder, every single felony has to go through a grand jury process in order to become a formal charge in court. So grand juries generally are convening and sitting and ruling on cases, so to speak, almost every day of the week. That means that these 23 or so individuals can't go to work that day, have to drive to Eugene, and they sit there for, you know, 8 hours or so listening to a variety of different cases on any given day. Then at some point the prosecutor will ask them, please return an indictment on this person. And at that point, certain number of jurors have to vote that there was enough information to prosecute. There are three different types of grand jury witnesses. One is target, one is suspect, and one is material witness. If you are in those first two categories of target or suspect, the federal government feels that they have enough information basically to indict you at this time. There are many pending grand jury proceedings at this time. Most, if not all, of the people that have been subpoenaed have been subpoenaed as targets or suspects. This is basically the first time, as far as I know, that the environmental movement has had so many people detained on such serious charges. You know, many of these charges are carrying with them life sentences or 20-year sentences or other serious amounts of jail time. And my understanding is for the last several years, there has been a constant grand jury focusing on environmental and animal rights actions, particularly in the Northwest, and that there wasn't a single crime that they were investigating. It was kind of a generic, large conspiracy investigation. And my understanding is that with the informants that are cooperating with the federal government at this time. Without that testimony, the federal government probably wouldn't have the case that it has today. But as a result of the informants and the information that they've provided, I think that we're going to see a lot more before this chapter of the book comes to a close. The number one way that the government gets someone to become a snitch is because they've got the goods on that person. Normally, it is a situation where the federal government is saying, you're going to go to jail for the rest of your life. And the only way that that will not happen is if you give us information. You know, obviously, individuals can have their own opinions on whether they agree or disagree with snitching, but I think everyone can agree that it's an extreme tragedy when someone is placed in this position where they have to decide between giving information about their friends and loved ones or going to jail for the rest of their lives. Personally, I feel that with the current government hype and this regime of repression that's going on right now, a crime that 5 years ago would have been vandalism and maybe the person would have gotten a 5-year sentence has now been trumped up under this ridiculous hype of domestic terrorism. The environmental movement and the animal rights movement has been very successful over the last decade in garnering public support and in illustrating to the public the real threats to our environment. And I think that the powers that be, whether they are corporations or more conservative politicians, have been fairly successful in trying to move that discussion away from those earlier topics. And I think that it is as a result of those political pressures that these people are finding themselves where they are right now. Unfortunately, informants and the informant system within the federal system is far, far, far more of a threat to normal citizens like you or I than the grand jury system is. There are no rules to the world of informing. And, you know, in drug cases, over 90% of all drug cases are won by the use of informants. Simply having a single informant can result in someone being convicted of a crime.
Lauren Regan of the Civil Liberties Defense Center.
There are oftentimes circumstances where a person does have a First Amendment or a Fifth Amendment right to not testify about a given circumstance. For instance, if someone has been deemed to be a target or a suspect of a grand jury, obviously they are most likely not going to wish to testify to that grand jury for fear of incriminating themselves. And so far, we still have the right not to incriminate ourselves. So oftentimes there are legal defenses and legal bases to assert those constitutional rights. The federal government will then have to react to that. It's called invoking your rights, you know, when you say, I'm not going to testify because, you know, I'm going to invoke these rights. Oftentimes, once a witness invokes their rights, the federal government will attempt to give them immunity, a very small, specific type of immunity. You don't really have any choice whether you want it or not. They will just thrust it upon you. Once immunity has been granted to a person, then they no longer have the right not to testify about a particular event, because basically what the government is saying is, you can go ahead and tell us all about this. We promise we're not going to prosecute you for this particular, you know, piece of information you're going to give up. And if you continue to not testify at that point, that is when the federal government will begin to initiate contempt proceedings against you. And there are two types of contempt. One is called civil contempt, which is not a crime and is the most often used regarding grand juries. Basically what happens is you are dragged in front of a judge and the judge says, you know, unless you testify, you're going to be found in contempt of court. And the person says, for whatever reasons, they're not going to testify. And then the court finds them in contempt. At that point, they are sentenced to jail. But the phrase that the cases use in these instances is that the person in jail actually holds the keys to their own jail cell. And what that means is as soon as the person agrees to testify and follow the court's order, they are immediately released from jail. This is different than a criminal contempt situation, which is a crime, and the courts actually impose a sentence of X number of days. So just to kind of clarify that, in civil contempt, you know, you could be thrown in jail and then the very next day decide you're going to testify and you would be let out. In criminal contempt, you would be sentenced to, let's say, 30 days in jail, and you would not be allowed out until those 30 days have passed. Now, because grand juries can be extended and because they take place over such long time periods, you know, 18 months to up to 36 months in some circumstances, that can mean that somebody who is being held in civil contempt can actually stay in jail for the entire duration of that grand jury. But if they can prove to a court that the purpose of putting them in jail, i.e. to coerce them to testify to a grand jury, if a witness can prove that the purpose of putting them in jail is not going to work and that they will never testify and that this punishment that the court is inflicting on them is going to be ineffective, then there is a specific kind of legal proceeding where you can basically be let out because of your unwillingness to testify before the grand jury. Basically, you have to prove to the court that your feelings are serious and legitimate and they're not going to change, and by leaving you in a jail cell, it's not going to make you change your mind and willingly participate. And so that's basically the civil contempt process, which is why it's so important that whenever anyone gets served with a grand jury subpoena, the first thing that they should do is to get a lawyer. There are criminal ramifications that can happen when someone testifies in a grand jury, and there is a very real potential for jail time oftentimes. Because you're walking into a situation where the federal government is your adversary, and they have a lot of experience in dealing with these types of circumstances, you really need somebody who understands the law and the grand jury process to make sure that your rights are upheld and to assist you in walking through this pretty archaic and complicated court process. Actually, far more dangerous than the grand jury process is the system of government informants. You know, at least you have some rights and the right to an attorney and, you know, some other things when you're dealing with the grand jury process. But other tactics that are certainly used by the federal government are things, you know, so it starts from the moment you receive the subpoena. You know, oftentimes people will be handed a subpoena and they will be told, you know, there's a way to avoid having to show up to this grand jury. You could simply make an appointment with us and tell us everything you know, and then you won't actually have to show up to this court proceeding. And there certainly have been allegations made by the National Lawyer Guild and other lawyer groups that many federal prosecutors are currently using the grand jury process to question represented people without their lawyers being present. Historically, grand juries have been used as a tool for political repression to frighten people or create mistrust or drive people out of movements or cause people to inform on their friends, you know, out of fear. This has gone back to the capture of escaped slaves to discredit the Puerto Rican independence movement. It was used to intimidate the families of anti-Vietnam protesters, as well as Black and Native American rights protesters as well. So our current generation of grand juries, this isn't the first time that a situation like this has occurred. You know, we only have to look back at history to see how these situations will play out.
That was Lauren Regan of the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, Oregon. Their website is www.cldc.org. They are currently planning a grand jury roadshow to educate the public about grand juries and informants. And they are having a fundraising event February 4th at 6:30 p.m. at Diva, 110 West Broadway in Eugene, Oregon. They will be having a raffle in conjunction with the fundraiser, and you can buy tickets locally at Mississippi Records, 4007 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. For more information about grand juries and government harassment, you can also go to the website www.fbiwitchhunt.com. Thank you for listening to Circle A Radio. We can be contacted through our website, www.circlearadio.org. You can also listen to some of our past shows on that website. We'd like to thank Brian Glick, Lauren Regan, Noelle Hanrahan, and the Pacifica Radio Archives. Our next show will be broadcast February 1st here on KBOO. Thanks for listening.
It's 7 o'clock, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.